This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Iowa presidential caucuses are just 11 weeks from now on February 1st, and then soon after, on February 9th, New Hampshire votes in its first-in-the-nation primary. And while Iowa's nominating event, a caucus, is not the same as a primary, there's no actual voting, for instance, and participation is pretty low, the results from Iowa can still shape the race from there on out. Although New Hampshire voters often make very different choices than their counterparts in Iowa. Today in The Exchange, we head to the Hawkeye State to see how the caucuses are shaping up for Republicans and Democrats, and we'll compare that picture to the Granite State. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Whether you're listening in New Hampshire or listening online in Iowa, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio is Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Josh, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Laura.
And joining us from Iowa, two guests, Clay Masters, Morning Edition host for Iowa Public Radio, where he reports on a wide variety of topics, including politics, health, and the environment. Clay Masters, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Ben Kiefer, host of IPR's daily noon talk show, River to River, which he also helps produce. And Ben Kiefer, welcome back. It's been a couple years, but we really appreciate you joining us again here on The Exchange.
Thanks for asking, Laura. Good morning from a very wet and rainy Iowa.
Well, Ben, I'll turn to you first. Just remind us, a caucus is not a primary. What is it?
Well, it depends on if you're in the Republican caucus or the Democratic caucus. These are party functions. So the Republicans do it a different way. Theirs is more like a secret ballot after they do some talking and gathering and so forth. These are gatherings for party organization to write platforms. There's a lot of things that go on. It takes a couple of hours. Now, it can be very, very exciting at times. I've been to a couple of them. Or it can be really quite boring unless you're really into the minutia of political life. You typically show up, depending on the size of your precinct. Often they are in gymnasiums of elementary schools. You show up. And there are posters on the wall showing which candidate you are to stand next to. You would see Barack Obama if this was 2008, John Edwards, for instance. You go stand by the poster whom you support, and then there is also one, a key poster, that is undecided. Okay, it is somehow marked that way. And then you can go ahead and get a sense, and the caucuses I've been, the last one I was in 2008, several hundred people in this elementary school gym. And then you kind of look around and you say, well, how much does Hillary have? How much does Barack Obama have? How much does John Edwards have? There are some speeches. And then they do this curious thing where you have to reach a 15% hurdle to be what is called viable. So they will take a count. And if you are not viable, if you were a long ways from viable, you might want to, and you will be cajoled to, throw your support to a different candidate. And that's what they say is one of the pluses of the caucuses, is your vote is not wasted, because if you are with someone who only has 5%, you can go over and join someone else to make their numbers greater.
So you have to publicly show who you support, though. I think
exactly.
A lot of New Hampshire people would have a problem with that, right? This is supposed to be private.
Right. And, I think Iowans are like that, too. The many would not turn up because it is not a secret ballot. You're cajoled, you're talked to. But there is sort of a charm to that. I think Clay would agree that you feel like you're in conversation with your neighbors about the issues and about the candidates. Not a solitary, isolated feeling. You are with your neighbors.
Well, and Clay, to you too, another thing that I heard from what Ben said is it takes a couple hours. I'm hearing our listeners thinking, wow, sometimes I barely have time to get to the polls and cast a ballot. Never mind, hang out for a couple hours. How much of a barrier is that to participation?
Well, again, that's an argument that gets thrown around every 4 years, especially from people outside of Iowa, is just the unfairness for those that might not be able to show up. You know, there's issues of if you're a parent, you need to find somebody to watch your kids. Military personnel stationed overseas can't participate because it's not like you can do early voting or mail in a ballot. So it's a commitment that you really have to get people to want to show up. And so a lot of times you get kind of what we often refer to as activists, right? So it's the people that really want to make a change. And if you look at how many people turn up year after year, a quick search shows that an average is about 16% of eligible voters in the Republican primaries and caucuses in 2012. The 2008 turnout rates for Democrats was something like 19%, and the Republicans was more like 10%. So really, what you're seeing with the Iowa caucuses is this real drive from the campaigns just to get people to show up on and commit to caucus, because it's not just showing up to a poll and checking. You know, I've talked with people that came to the 2008 caucus expecting, you know, not even knowing what to expect, and that was when Barack Obama was doing so well, and precincts were just flooded with people, and it was, you know, this wild event, not like just showing up to the poll in the morning, getting your little sticker and leaving.
Well, why does Iowa do it this way, Clay? I mean, again, those participation rates are not very impressive.
Well, I think from my perspective, you know, I haven't covered as many of these as Ben has, and maybe he can speak to a little bit more, but I think it really gives it a way for there to be this statewide national dialogue, for people to really talk about the issues and to motivate people to want to come out. And it's different. And so that sets it apart from a lot of other early primary states like New Hampshire. And so I haven't covered politics out in New Hampshire, but I assume that it's a quite different campaign event out there, in that, you know, you're trying to get people to just, campaigns in New Hampshire are trying to get people just to show up and vote on that day.
Sure. Well, Ben, go ahead and jump in, and then we've got Josh Rogers here for the New Hampshire primary. But
yeah,
Ben, go ahead.
I'd just like to share a memory. We talked about the 2008 caucuses here in Iowa. This was amazing. As an observer, I went to the caucuses at a neighborhood school in Iowa City, and the Hillary Clinton people were all decked out in signs, stickers. They even had sandwiches for those who showed up. So walking from the parking lot to the building, it looked like, oh, well, Hillary's people are here out in force. Didn't see any sign of Barack Obama's people. Went in there. There are some, you know, the preliminaries that happen. And then we got to the question of viability there. And at one point, there was an energy in the building that swept through, and the Obama people really got the momentum. And what was interesting, Laura, in this day and age when we're all connected by cell phones, is that people in their group, say you were in the Hillary Clinton group or the Barack Obama group, you were telephoning, you were contacting people in other precincts in the state or in town. And all of a sudden, this sweeping momentum was magnified because you feel the whole state and is going a certain way if you're a Barack Obama supporter. And that's indeed what happened, that you it was really by the end of the evening. And of course, Barack Obama ended up Clinton in 2008. I remember watching the Hillary Clinton people kind of mope out of the hall at the end of the evening, because it was not at all what they expected, and of course not what the nation expected.
So a lot of excitement and a test of organization. That's often how Iowa is described.
Yes.
Although I do wonder, Ben, again, some problems with this. You know, only certain people can show up. The turnout is pretty low. I mean, why
no
do you guys?
Ballot.
Yeah, why
yeah,
do
no
you guys do it
ballot.
This way?
you know, I don't know except that it grew out of the party organization and mm-hmm. the experience of when I've talked to political analysts, the experience of the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. That was really a debacle, not a good thing
there.
For the party.
Yeah.
Very messy. So it was an attempt, and I think Iowa became first, and this is important. Iowa's important. Iowa is important because it's first. It's not first because it's Iowa. Right.
And so
perhaps happenstance contributed to Iowa becoming first. But once it became first, and we had Jimmy Carter in 1976, this unknown peanut farmer from Georgia come to Iowa and become known by knocking on doors and talking to regular people. Iowa knew what they had. And then you saw people saying, we are not going to give this up. And that's why it's in law that people cannot jump leapfrog ahead of Iowa.
Well, I don't want to forget New Hampshire as well. And we've got NHPR's Josh Rogers with us, senior political reporter for us here at NHPR. And so, Josh, in general, New Hampshire's primary is just a regular vote. You show up. But there is this independent factor in the New Hampshire primary, which makes it interesting.
Yes, it's an open primary, meaning that people who are undeclared, which is how we refer to independents, can pick whatever ballot they choose, vote on the Republican side or the Democratic side. Most people who are undeclared, and they are a growing share of the electorate here, you know, tend to pick the one ballot, you know, over and over again. There are not that many people who actually, you know, jump back and forth between one election voting Republican, one election voting Democrat. But that, you know, in the eyes of people who see New Hampshire as a better test of sort of general election viability for a candidate in a primary than perhaps a caucus state would produce.
Sure. And as we're hearing from our Iowa guests, there it seems like it's almost hyper-partisan. You really have to be committed to your party, to its platform, to its ideas, to its candidates to show up. In New Hampshire, it's wide open.
Well, history would suggest that in New Hampshire, in order to win the primary, you still have to get the lion's share of votes of voters within your party or the party within your party. You can't – the idea that you can bank on winning because of independence is perhaps a bit of a myth. But you know, because it's an open primary and because it's relatively easy to participate, the turnout does tend to be high. 2008, which is, you know, obviously was a big turnout in Iowa as well. In New Hampshire, 54% of eligible voters voted. Obviously, you had Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on the Democratic side. You had John McCain, Mitt Romney on the Republican side, and other big name people on the Republican side as well. So that drove turnout. And an interesting statistic from that year is apparently, according to one poll, 18% of voters that year claimed to have shaken hands with a candidate.
How many, Josh? Say it again.
18%.
Okay.
Which is a high number, but that still means 82% didn't shake hands. But, you know, you look at 2012, in which President Obama was running for reelection, therefore you didn't have a Democratic primary, and you had 30.6% turnout, which, you know, still was about fourth or fifth in terms of overall states, but, I mean, a huge drop from when both sides have competitive races, which is obviously what we're looking at this year.
Wow. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're heading over to the Hawkeye state of Iowa to check in on that other first-in-the-nation contest, with Iowa's caucuses coming about a week before New Hampshire's presidential primary next year. We're going to find out what the candidates are saying in Iowa, how their campaigns are playing out in that state, and of course, we'll keep an eye on the Granite State as well. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Whether you're listening to us here in New Hampshire or online in Iowa, join us, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk a little bit more about the voter bases, gentlemen. And Clay Masters, to you first, how would you describe the demographics and the politics of Iowa Republicans? Let's take them first.
Well, the Iowa Republicans have really been driven by the evangelical vote. Tea Partiers, especially in the last two Iowa caucuses in 2012, Rick Santorum. Remember, Rick Santorum won, but it wasn't known until a few days after the Iowa caucuses that he won. Mitt Romney was seen as the winner. And then in 2008, Mike Huckabee actually was the caucus winner then. So that has shown that evangelicals really turn up. But then in 2000, way back in 2000, then governor of Texas, George W. Bush, was very popular among establishment and evangelical Republican voters. And, you know, he went on to be president for a couple terms. So it's been interesting the last 8 years in who Iowa Republicans have chosen. So this year will be quite interesting when we have a wide-open caucus here this year for both the Republicans and the Democrats.
And real quick, Josh, how about New Hampshire Republicans? Not the evangelical focus that we see in Iowa, yes or no?
Well, there certainly are some socially conservative people, but you know, New Hampshire is one of the most secular states, and traditionally the GOP electorate here has been focused on fiscal matters and is less interested in social issues. And you can certainly see that in candidates who played well among Iowa Republicans, like Mike Huckabee, like Rick Santorum. You know, Mitt Romney's sort of an outlier. He almost had a home state advantage here and was really perceived to be the overwhelming early front runner in the GOP race last time. You know, Pat Robertson did well in Iowa, not so hot here.
Wow, that's a blast from the past.
So
yeah.
It's a different ball game. And the idea of a candidate who can necessarily straddle on the GOP side those two electorates is increasingly a challenge. And I don't believe anyone who wasn't an incumbent has won both states on the Republican side, I believe, since Reagan.
Wow, that's interesting. So the Republicans looking for a candidate who can straddle the very different electorates in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's a feat. And you look at the people who on paper were perceived to be straddlers. I mean, George W. Bush was a good example. And, you know, he did well in Iowa when he came to New Hampshire and was clobbered by John McCain. Obviously, it didn't slow him down too much ultimately. But people who on paper, people are saying, oh, who can be in that sort of evangelical Tea Party world also appeal to more moderate and potentially kind of so-called country club Republicans. And there are not that many out there, but the guys who are often cast that way, you know, don't tend to pan out. I mean, one person who had been perceived to be have the potential of running strong in both states this time around was Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. That doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about Rand Paul's candidacy, given the attacks in Paris, a lot more focus on national security. But since you mentioned Mike Huckabee, again, the winner in 2008, let's hear a little bit from Mike Huckabee this time around. Here he is. He was the first in Arkansas to file for his presidential run. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, describing his strategy this time around.
Our strategy is the same as it always was. We're going to outwork everybody. We're going to organize in the early states. We'll win the early states because that's how you ultimately win the nomination. I might take a little issue that we've been outshadowed by all the other candidates. I'm not sure that I would characterize it that way. We're quite ahead of where we were 8 years ago at this point.
So, Ben Kiefer, what about Mike Huckabee, and maybe we can talk about Rick Santorum as well, the very religiously based conservative candidates who did quite well in Iowa but then fizzled later during the presidential mm-hmm. nomination.
It was interesting what Huckabee said there about being outshadowed. He somewhat disagreed with that. I would agree with that he has been outshadowed. In this case, it seems to be Ben Carson who is, at least at the moment, polling well among Iowa evangelicals. Huckabee is a very affable, very charming man. When you meet him in person and interviewing him, politics aside, he's a very likable person. Also, the same for Rick Santorum, who won in 2008, also appealing to Christian evangelicals in Iowa. But, and this gets really, Laura, to the point of what the Iowa caucus is about. He wasn't declared a winner until days after the Iowa caucuses. And, you know, the Republicans had a problem counting. It was very close, and I think he won by 8 votes. But the newspaper headline on the day after the caucuses was not Santorum wins, but Romney wins. And that is the effect. That is the reason Iowa is important, is because this is a sequential primary, and it's sort of the ripple effect. Iowa sets out a ripple toward New Hampshire. Now, a candidate can capitalize on that ripple or not, but Santorum, though, he did win. In actual fact, he had missed the wave, I guess, to mix metaphors and be a surfer all of a sudden.
Out there in Iowa, that would be a little difficult. But Josh Rogers, right. How much have we seen of these two candidates, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee in New Hampshire?
Of remarkably little. Not surprisingly, I guess, given the state of the race. And I agree that certainly there have been candidates who have sucked up part of the electorate that they would be most theoretically appeal to. I mean, it's interesting, Rick Santorum. I remember when he headed off to the caucuses. I went to his final event before he left for weeks of campaigning in Iowa. There were a couple of people at a house party, and then even though he won, but he was perceived to be came in second. That still did boost his fortunes in New Hampshire. I mean, a strong finish. You know, the window between Iowa and New Hampshire, whoever does well in Iowa certainly gets a lot more of a look from voters here, regardless of how they ultimately decide.
We will talk more in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the campaign trail in Iowa, which holds its caucuses about a week before New Hampshire's primary. And if you're listening in New Hampshire or online in Iowa, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What candidates are attracting attention in your state? What candidates are attracting your own attention? And what do you make of some of the issues that they're bringing to the campaign trail? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Clay Masters, Morning Edition host for Iowa Public Radio, where he reports on a wide variety of topics. Ben Kiefer is also with us, host of IPR's daily noon talk show called River to River. And in studio with me here in New Hampshire, Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for NHPR. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Clay, I did want to ask you about Donald Trump, because we heard in that clip from Mike Huckabee, I don't feel like I'm being overshadowed by other candidates, meaning probably Carson and Trump. How is Donald Trump playing in Iowa, Clay?
Well, it's interesting that when Donald Trump first announced, there was a lot of attention to it, and he had these moments that seemed like they would destroy a campaign, but they didn't. I remember there was a family leadership summit in Ames, Iowa, back in the summer, and it was when Donald Trump made the comments that he thought that John McCain was not a war hero, and that he liked people that were vets that were not captured. Very controversial comments that were made. You would think that that would damage a campaign. It did not. He's gone on to say other things that have been controversial, and it led up to this 90-minute rant that he had in Fort Dodge, Iowa, a couple weeks ago, where he made some comments about Ben Carson and likened his persona or pathology, I think was the way that he put it, to that of a child molester. He also talked about whenever he's down in the polls here, when Ben Carson is ahead, he will, not limit the name calling to those with high profiles. You know, he basically called Iowa voters stupid. So there's kind of
that's
this
an interesting way to gain support in Iowa.
It is. So you know, with Donald Trump, you think that something like that is going to hurt, but you know, he's been saying a lot of stuff, and it hasn't hurt too much. There have been some polls recently that show him below Ben Carson here. So, you know, Donald Trump is definitely an interesting person to follow, and I would say that he is overshadowing Mike Huckabee.
Well, and we do have a clip from that long speech that Mr. Trump gave recently in Iowa. Spent a lot of time at this rally, instead of talking about what he would do, criticizing Ben Carson. Here, Trump raises Carson's references in his book to what Carson calls his pathological temper when he was a teen. Let's hear Donald Trump.
So he said he has pathological disease. Now, if you're pathological, there's no cure for that, folks. Okay? There's no cure for that. And I did one of the shows today. And I don't want to say what I said, but I'll tell you anyway. I said that if you're a child molester, a sick puppy, you're a child molester, there's no cure for that.
So again, that's Donald Trump speaking in Dodge City, Iowa last week, criticizing Ben Carson. And Ben Kiefer, I have to ask you, how did this long anti-Carson speech play in Iowa, given that at this point, Iowans seem to prefer Ben Carson?
We've been playing for months now, ever since Trump entered the race. As Clay mentioned, he seems to say one thing after another that you think is going to make him plummet in the polls, and he doesn't. He defies political gravity. I regularly discuss politics here in Iowa with more than a dozen of Iowa's top political scientists, and very early on, they were unanimous, saying this guy is going down. He's going to be a Michelle Bachmann. He's going to be a Herman Cain. Remember that name from 2008?
I do remember.
But he has remained there. Now, as we just heard, these comments he makes are quite extreme. Can he continue to defy political gravity? Well, some of the political scientists I'm talking with here are sort of begrudgingly admitting that he may continue on if his, of course, if his polls numbers stay up there, he may have a shot at the nomination.
And Josh, go ahead, Clay. Yeah,
I also want to get to something here too, that everybody that I speak to about the Iowa caucuses says that people make up their minds towards the end. So this is kind of like the NASCAR race for some of those that are polling in third or fourth. They're waiting for the crashes to happen and for them to be able to pull ahead. So you look at some of the most recent Iowa polls that have been done by the Des Moines Register's Ann Selzer, who's the gold standard for polling in Iowa, and you look at somebody like Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, and you just kind of have to think, okay, they might have their time to shine too. Because if you go back to 2012, Ben brought up Herman Cain and Michelle Bachmann. You know, Newt Gingrich was also a name that was peaking. I don't remember the dates specifically, but there were these different weeks where it was their time to shine in the national spotlight. But Donald Trump and Ben Carson have been taking up a lot of that light for a lot of these weeks. And then you had Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum really coming to the front and winning the Iowa caucuses. And they say that there are three tickets out of Iowa. So you kind of keep your eye on who those top three candidates are going to be coming forward.
Three tickets out of Iowa, Clay. What does that mean?
It means that to build the momentum, you need to basically. So it means that there are usually three people that come out of Iowa's caucuses, especially in a large field like the Republicans have this year, that can go on to get the nomination. So I've been waiting for you to make that joke about Iowa picks corn, New Hampshire picks the president, but I guess I'll invoke it first. That joke is kind of cute, and yes, the last couple go-rounds on the Republican side have not been too predictive, but remember, Iowa was big for President Obama in 2008. In 2008, that's when Hillary Clinton came in third in the Iowa caucuses.
Right.
So, and even so, on the eve of the 2012 election, President Obama came to Des Moines with the First Lady and Bruce Springsteen. He shut down a long section of road downtown up to the Capitol and, you know, was shouting, it all started here, Iowa. And in the 2000 caucuses, it was, again, largely that evangelical and the establishment vote that helped elect Texas Governor George W. Bush. So this year's really going to be an interesting year. A lot of people talk about how Iowa doesn't choose the president, it winnows the field. And with the rise in super PACs this year, you have candidates sustaining their campaigns based on their PACs, not the campaigns itself, which is also something really interesting. And so it's all about if you take someone like a Ted Cruz winning the caucuses by a big spread, if he has his time to shine, and there are all these other people that they have to choose for, and, you know, then you start to wonder if that person doesn't go on to get the nominee and he or she is won by this huge margin, then those warnings of Reince Priebus, the chairman for the RNC, saying, you know, Iowa, don't get too comfortable, you know, then you start to wonder how relevant Iowa would be moving forward.
Well, I was going to ask Josh Rogers to make that comment about, you know, Iowa picks corn, New Hampshire picks presidents, but you already did it, Clay, so I don't have to. But Josh, since we talked about Donald Trump, from what I've read, Ben Carson is ahead of Donald Trump in Iowa. Here in New Hampshire, Donald Trump is ahead of Ben Carson. What do you know about that?
Well, Donald Trump's led the polls for a long time. Carson is up there underneath him. But you talk to Republicans on the ground, and you couldn't say it was anybody's ball game, but you could still say it's many people's potential ball game. Like everyone else, a lot of Republicans have been waiting for the sort of air to come out of Trump's campaign. Maybe that'll happen. Maybe it won't. But there are a number of Republicans, Marco Rubio, certainly Cruz has picked up some steam in New Hampshire. Chris Christie has actually improved his standing in New Hampshire. John Kasich is spending a lot of time. There are a lot of people who are banking on a good performance here. It's very, very wide open on the Republican side. And, you know, it's worth remembering that the primary and the caucuses are taking place a month later this go around than they were in the last.
Right.
So it is, you know, it's getting close, but there's still a lot of time for things to happen. And all you have to you look at the way something, you know, we don't know how the attacks in Paris reshape things and whether or not that takes some of the wind out of the non-traditional politicians' campaigns a bit. I mean, there's so many variables at this point, and a lot of it's going to hinge on, you know, how well these campaigns can do mobilizing their vote and getting them to the polls. That's kind of, you know, a not terribly profound thing to say, but that is what it often boils down to.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk about how the attacks in Paris and heightened concerns about terrorism terrorism, national security are playing out on both the Republican and Democratic side. So I'm glad you raised that, Josh. Let me also remind our listeners that you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. And again, if you're listening in Iowa online or, of course, here in the Granite State, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's a Facebook comment from Tim, who says, I've participated in both an Iowa caucus and several New Hampshire primaries. Primaries are far superior. Caucuses limit participation, are subject to parliamentary manipulation, and are hardly reflective of the general electorate who will vote in November. Just compare the turnout numbers. Tim says, remember, too, the February caucuses select delegates to county conventions, who then select delegates to congressional districts and ultimately the state convention. Positions, Tim says, can and do change along the route. And then here's an email from Don in Londonderry, who kind of agrees with Tim. He says, New Hampshire is an election. Party activists try to rally the electorate to come out and vote. Iowa is a joint meeting of all local party organizations on the same night. It is only intended for party members to show support. These are the people who have lawn signs, hold signs on street corners during elections, attend house parties, and call voters during dinner. One is a statewide election. One is a party event. So, Iowa guys, two comments from our New Hampshire listeners, Ben Kiefer, saying, you know, good for you, Iowa, but it's not that good.
With that last comment, I half agree. Certainly, party activists are all about the caucuses, and they will be there. But because the Iowa caucuses come, the presidential ones, every 4 years, I would say that my observations tell me that it's more than just party activists, people. People go there because it is a unique event and it's a fun event. Now, of course, they have to be politically active and be engaged in the political debate. But I wouldn't want to give New Hampshire or the rest of the country the idea that it is only sort of party political people, really active political people. It is everyday people who show up at these caucuses to join in. It's and we said it was 2 hours, but generally they have the vote, the viability vote early on, and the adjusting and jostling and cajoling early on. So you can be out of there within an hour, depending on the size of your precinct. They tend to put the minutiae of the political party agenda toward the end, and that's when only the activists are hanging on until 10 or 11 at night.
All right. Well, thanks for those comments, both Don and Tim. You can join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. So let's talk about Democrats, gentlemen. And Clay, to you first. There was a big, of course, Democratic debate in Iowa just over the weekend. Three candidates now. All of you mentioned before how the electorate among Republicans in Iowa is more religiously conservative. What about Democrats, Clay? If Iowa Republicans tend to be very conservative, are Iowa Democrats very liberal?
Yeah, that's the impression that I've been getting. This is my first go-round with covering the Iowa caucuses here, and that's kind of what I've been told, is that on one side you have a very Republican right wing and you have a very liberal left wing. And, you know, there is a lot of momentum here for both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Also, though, Martin O'Malley has been in the state a lot. He's not really taking off like I know he would hope he would be at this point. But, you know, with Iowa voters making up their mind at the last minute, Iowa caucus goers might be looking for an alternative to the two front runners.
What's your sense, Josh, of how national security concerns have shaken up these races, Democratic or Republican side?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. It's still early. I do think it's certainly heightened voters' interest in these matters. You looked at the questions asked in the debate. The big chunk of it at the top was all about national security, understandably so. You know, the conventional thinking would be that this would probably augur to the benefit of Hillary Clinton, given her experience as Secretary of State. You know, people who are not supportive of Secretary Clinton and who back Bernie Sanders might say, well, you know, there are a bunch of decisions she's made in her political career, ranging from, you know, her vote on the Iraq War to other things that, you know, suggest that this may not be a pure benefit to her. But you look at the way at the top of the debate when Sanders was asked a question, it was a very terse statement about, you know, the need to handle the situation with ISIS. And then you know, but let's turn to what I want to talk about, which, you know, we'll see how that we'll see. I mean, it is interesting. I mean, the conventional thinking certainly, you know, to broaden this to Republicans, I mean, the thing among a lot of Republicans, the rule of thumb is, oh, if we're talking about, you know, issues of national security, you know, Republicans tend to be in a better situation than Democrats. And if we're talking about, you know, anything else, maybe Democrats are in a better situation with the electorate. You know, it's too soon to know how this is going to play out. And also, you know, the fortunes of both parties on this question are going to also hinge on how voters perceive the president is handling this situation.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit. Yeah, go ahead, Clay. Yeah.
I'd just say, too, that Josh brings up an interesting point, too, that what Hillary Clinton has, you saw it in the debate in Des Moines on Saturday, is she's walking this fine line of both supporting the president and also trying to show that she's different. So she's walking this very fine line where, you know, she mentions that the so-called Islamic State cannot be contained. It has to be defeated. Earlier, I think it was even that day or the day before, that's when President Obama used that line of ISIS will be contained. And so that was something that was, you could tell, was rehearsed, and that's her way of trying to set her part of almost being a little more hawkish on foreign policy than him.
Well, since we're talking about it, let's play a little bit of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. We'll go to Hillary Clinton first on how she would respond to this rising concern about terrorism and ISIS.
But it cannot be an American fight. And I think what the president has consistently said, which I agree with, is that we will support those who take the fight to ISIS. That is why we have troops in Iraq that are helping to train and build back up the Iraqi military, why we have special operators in Syria working with the Kurds and Arabs, so that we can be supportive. But this cannot be an American fight, although American leadership is essential.
Okay, again, that's Hillary Clinton talking at the debate about national security. Ben Kiefer, how did this go over among Iowa voters? What's your sense?
Well, I haven't done a lot of, I mean, it's been just a few days.
Sure.
Of this, so I can mostly just speculate about this, that as Clay said, she's walking a line here. But of the three that stood on the stage for Democrats, she seemed to be the most commander-in-chief-ish, if I can put it that way. Also interesting is the ramifications in the Republican ranks. I'm interviewing Ron Paul tomorrow for my talk show here.
Rand Paul.
I'm still in 2008.
It's understandable, and I was wondering perhaps the father was helping the son with his campaign. Go ahead, Ben.
Rand Paul, excuse me. I'm interviewing Rand Paul tomorrow, and it's really interesting. Of course, conventional wisdom is saying that a person who wants much less intervention for America abroad would suffer in this sort of climate if the Paris attack continues to be the focus of our news.
Yeah, I had heard that too. Clay, I wonder if you want to quickly jump in there. Some people say, you know, the heightened concerns about ISIS and Paris and so forth have, I don't want to say spelled doom for anybody's candidacy, but make it tougher for Rand Paul to make his case that we should have a hands-off approach.
Yeah, and Bernie Sanders, ahead of the Des Moines debate this weekend, too, when they announced that they were going to be flipping the format and we're going to be leading with foreign policy, there were reports that the Sanders campaign was not happy with that because, you can read through the lines. And as Josh mentioned, with him making a statement about his opening statement, or in his opening statement saying something about ISIS, but then pivoting directly, you know, we should not be, propping up the millionaires and billionaire class. So, you know, somebody like Sanders, somebody like Rand Paul, who a lot of times sets himself apart from a lot of his Republican
candidates. Clay, I got to cut you off there. I do apologize. We will follow up in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we turn to Iowa for a look at the presidential nomination process there with the caucuses about a week before New Hampshire's first in the nation primary. And if you're listening in the Granite State or online in Iowa, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We want your thoughts, questions, comments about the caucuses or the primaries, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour with me in studio, Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for us here at NHPR. And from Iowa, Ben Kiefer, host of IPR's daily noon talk show, River to River. Also with us, Clay Masters, morning edition host for Iowa Public Radio. And he reports on a wide variety of topics as well, including politics, health, and the environment. And gentlemen, we were wrapping up looking at the Democratic field in Iowa, and I did want to play a little bit of Bernie Sanders. Again, all of you saying that the foreign policy arena is less firm ground for Senator Sanders. Still, let's hear what Senator Sanders said in that Iowa debate recently with questions about terrorism and ISIS and so forth.
Well, let me have one area of disagreement with the secretary. I think she said something like, the bulk of the responsibility is not ours. Well, in fact, I would argue that the disastrous invasion of Iraq, something that I strongly opposed, has unraveled the region completely and led to the rise of Al-Qaeda and to ISIS. Now, in fact, what we have got to do, and I think there is widespread agreement here, is the United States cannot do it alone. What we need to do is lead an international coalition which includes, very significantly, the Muslim nations in that region who are going to have to fight and defend their way of life.
So again, that's Bernie Sanders speaking at the Democratic debate in Iowa just this weekend. And as we look at the Democratic field and how it's playing out in Iowa, Ben Kiefer, last question. I read that Martin O'Malley, the third candidate in this field, has said that he's going to basically park himself in Iowa. His words.
Well, we haven't seen much of him lately, so we'll look for him, especially Clay will be out. Perhaps Clay has been covering him when he has been here. I know Martin O'Malley has a following, small, but here in Iowa in the single digits. Perhaps, Clay, I don't know if you've been out to his events.
Yeah, Clay, go ahead.
Well, Martin O'Malley's been spending a lot of time here, and, you know, it's interesting when he said that he's going to be parking here and being here all the time. Yeah, it's kind of what Scott Walker, the Wisconsin governor, said just a few days before he dropped out of the race. I'm not saying that O'Malley is going to do the same, but that has kind of been something that's happened. You know, Rick Perry was spending more time here right around the time when he dropped out, and I think it's a different playing out on the Democratic side. But also, you know, people don't have to come to Iowa and talk about Iowa. They're coming to Iowa and talking about the issues that are involved in the nationwide, and especially now with foreign policy taking a bigger role in what people are talking about, because you're trying to get those national poll numbers out so you can debate on that main debate stage. So when you knuckle down and work in Iowa, I'm not sure that it's going to help as much as some of the candidates might think. I mean, it's probably sometimes your only option, but with this many candidates on the Republican side, I think you'd just want to stay in until the caucuses and the primary vote there in New Hampshire.
So maybe 20 years ago, Clay, it was a better strategy when these early nominating contests mattered so much. Now it's about national polls, getting on that debate stage, big money, advertisers on television, and so forth.
Yeah, and I digress a little bit from your original question about Martin O'Malley. And if you look at the Clinton side, or if you look at the Democratic side, you have Hillary Clinton. Let's use the Jefferson Jackson dinner a couple weeks ago as an example to kind of show what the race looks like in Iowa. So this is a multi-candidate event where they come, the presidential candidates speak before a large auditorium audience, and ahead of time, Hillary Clinton had Katy Perry, and on the other side of the Des Moines River, a guy in his 60s was playing acoustic guitar for Bernie Sanders while another guy was holding a lyric sheet up and he was singing some kind of impromptu song about feeling the burn, and then he led this march over the river. Sanders had people that were on the outsides of the barricades where this rally was. I was asked by somebody, is Bernie Sanders actually going to speak here? They didn't know where to go, really. And then you contrast that with Clinton, and she has, you know, a lot of staff here. Her events are really easy to get into. You know where you need to be. And really, it feels pretty similar to 2012, covering the general election and how events were set up for both President Obama and Mitt Romney. So that's kind of an interesting thing to note. And then you have Martin O'Malley, that same weekend at the Jefferson Jackson dinner. He was playing guitar with some local musicians, and, you know, it was kind of a representation of how all the different campaigns are playing out in here. So Martin O'Malley...
playing literally, Clay, right? Playing guitar.
Yeah, he was been known to wield a guitar.
Yeah, that's what I've heard about Martin O'Malley.
And on The View.
Well, and turning back to the Republican side, I did want to ask all of you about Jeb Bush. And first to you, Josh Rogers, Jeb Bush has said that New Hampshire is very important to him.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, he's one of a number of Republicans. And, you know, to Clay's point, when somebody hangs it all on, you know, Iowa or New Hampshire, it's rarely a sign of strength. You know, even if practically speaking, it may be implausible for all but the rarest of candidates to necessarily think that they're going to do spectacularly well in both states. You know, as far as Jeb Bush goes, he sort of essentially tried to relaunch his campaign here a couple of weeks ago. After the bad debate performance 2 debates ago. You know, obviously entered the race with the blessing and the burden of the Bush name, with vast financial resources. He still has, you know, millions and millions of dollars of super PAC backing. But what's unclear is whether or not he can actually captivate the people who are going to vote. And
here in New Hampshire.
Well, elsewhere, too. I mean, yeah. I don't think there's any place where he's doing particularly well. I mean, he started saying, oh, he's going to run in a joyful way. I'm the tortoise in this race. I will ultimately grind it out and win people over. I will show people my record in Florida is one they should respect. Donald Trump's comment that he seemed low energy, I think, is something that maybe a lot of people felt, fairly or unfairly. It certainly stung him. And, you know, his efforts to break through and connect and create moments can come across as awkward. A lot of Republicans I talk to, when they see him in person, say they're very impressed with the former Florida governor's grasp of policy issues. But I'm not sensing a great deal of passion among the electorate. You know, he says he better win New Hampshire, I think, is basically something that he recognizes and people in his orbit recognize. He would have the resources to hang on. And, you know, people who have been close to the Bush family through the years know that they can be very tough campaigners. So I guess we'll see. But New Hampshire looms very large for Governor Bush. Whether voters, you know, feel that way about his prospects here, we'll see.
Yeah, we have heard his campaign say New Hampshire is important. He has been spending a lot of time here. You're right, Josh. Let's hear from Jeb Bush in Iowa. Here he is during a speech before just a few dozen folks gathered at a Coca-Cola bottling plant in Atlantic, Iowa. He talks about solving problems as Florida's governor.
That's what a servant does. The master may just say, I'm the big dog in the room, just get out of the way, I'll tell you when you talk. But I think you have to first listen to people, and then you learn from their challenges. And then when you learn from their challenges, you apply the things that you know how to do to fix things.
Again, that's Jeb Bush speaking in Atlantic, Iowa recently. Ben, I think I'll turn to you. What do you pull out of that? Some people said, for example, the master servant language was sort of targeted towards evangelicals. Other people said big dog versus listener was sort of Jeb Bush comparing himself to Donald Trump. What do you pull out of that? Ben, can you hear me? All right. Clay, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
All right. Go ahead. I'll let you take that one while we're looking for Ben.
Yeah, I would say that you've hit the nail on the head there. Another interesting thing about Jeb Bush, too, is, you know, about a month ago I had the opportunity to interview him. And my first question to him was, you know, you're doing your longest swing through Iowa this week. Why haven't you been focusing some more time on Iowa? And he kind of shot back with, well, actually, I've been here quite a bit. And he started talking about how you build on your success, and they just started to advertise. And then he corrected himself, saying, you know, actually the Right to Rise PAC has started to advertise. Campaign finance law says that super PACs and the campaigns can't coordinate, they can't talk. And there you have kind of a slip up in the tongue and saying, well, actually it's the super PAC that's been advertising. But that points to a point that I made earlier, in that you have these campaigns that are really alive still because of super PAC money that can pour millions of dollars into an election. So you're seeing a lot of Jeb Bush on TV. He's here, drops in every once in a while, but he is kind of upping his presence here a little bit more, although he still tends to be kind of in the lower digits in polling in Iowa.
Josh?
You know, one thing that's interesting about Jeb Bush is that there have been a lot of advertisements, some run by his campaign, some run on his behalf by Right to Rise. And there's hasn't been much evidence as of yet that they've been helping him, which is something that a lot of people watching this race have said is a bad sign for him. I mean, he's going to be back up. He's actually going to be officially filing for the New Hampshire primary later this week. And, you know, we'll see. But he's among a clutch of the more establishment figures who are banking on a strong performance in New Hampshire. You know, governors and former governors, you know, you could throw Chris Christie and John Kasich in that category, who seem to believe, and on paper it would be the case that they're sort of, you know, conservative, but sort of a conservative to sort of center right, you know, positions on a lot of these issues would be ones that would serve them well in the New Hampshire electorate traditionally. You know, we'll see. I mean, you know, somebody made the comment that the rule of thumb is that there are sort of three tickets out of Iowa, and you know, while that may have changed, you know, in the sort of super PAC era, you know, it in New Hampshire, it's often been perceived as, you know, maybe there are three tickets out, but you really need to be in first or second to profit enough. Somebody like Bush, you know, maybe that's a different circumstance, and you know, certainly there's been thinking that if, you know, one of these governors can get into the race, get into the South, where the so-called sort of SEC primaries take place, and if you could rack up votes there. But, you know, you have people like Ted Cruz who are going to be sort of like laying in the weeds and hoping to do well down there. It's really, I mean, it's very hard to know what's going to happen in the Republican side at this point.
We haven't even talked about Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and how they're doing. And some people say, Josh, correct me if I'm wrong, that those two senators are now rising.
Well, they have been gaining traction and having attended a bunch of Rubio's last swing through New Hampshire, you could definitely see this came on the heels of his strong debate performances. And there are definitely a lot of people who were giving him a real look. Now, he hasn't been here a lot, and you know, it remains to be seen if, you know, with a lot of voters giving him the look and a lot of more scrutiny from rivals, how he handles that. Thus far, it seems to be going all right. Again, when you get to, are these guys running a on-the-ground campaign? That's an open question with a lot of these people. By, you know, traditional standards, a lot of these Republicans seem to have a lighter footprint than they've had in years past. But I mean, that may speak to the level at which a lot of this campaigning is really going on the debate stage and on television these days. Obviously, voters are going to still have their role, but it feels like a slightly different animal.
Yeah, that is interesting to hear you say that, Josh. So there's sort of three approaches, maybe. One is, you know, heavy duty Iowa. One is heavy duty New Hampshire, and one is, you know, that national campaign, debates, big money ads, and so forth.
Well, I mean, you look at one thing a lot of people look at is like, okay, well, who's the person if you're, you know, and this is, you know, tactically relevant in Iowa and you know, it's relevant everywhere, but if you can be, you know, in everybody's top, if everybody feels you're in their top three choices, and then, you know, to, you know, revisit the NASCAR analogy and, you know, one of those other people spins out, well, then you may be in a position to reap the benefit of that. You can certainly get the sense, and a lot of people believe that, you know, Ted Cruz, for instance, is gunning for the Trump voters. And if Trump were to fall by the wayside, then, you know, he would hope that those folks would gravitate towards him, for instance.
Sure. Well, someone else who may benefit if one of these leading candidates crashes, so to speak, and who has been doing very well on her own, by the way, is Carly Fiorina, former Hewlett-Packard CEO. And Ben Kiefer, just give us a little sketch of how Mrs. Fiorina is playing in Iowa.
Well, it's interesting. In all of her debates, I've observed that, you know, she's been quite hawkish in her her comments about foreign policy, that she would demonstrate to Putin who's the lone superpower in the world and so forth. So you would think that this turn of events in Paris, the tragedy there, would favor a hawkish person. But we have to also remember in the Republican ranks that Lindsey Graham sits on the Armed Services Committee. You mentioned John Kasich. When he was in the House, he spent nearly 20 years on the Armed Services Committee when he served in the House. Lindsey Graham there in the Senate. So I would watch their poll numbers to see if they're taking advantage of that. Carly Fiorina, she had that wonderful debate. And then after that, it was really a question to me. And the analysts I talked to were really puzzled why she wasn't able to follow through with that strong debate performance, exceeding expectations, why it didn't follow through with the poll numbers. And
well, actually, Clay Masters asked her about that. So let's hear what Carly Fiorina said in response to your question, Clay. You asked her, you know, outsiders, Trump and Carson, have been doing well. How are you going to set yourself apart from them?
Well, I have a completely different resume than either Donald Trump or Ben Carson. I started as a secretary. eventually became a chief executive, and I did that by leading others and producing results over and over and over. I understand the economy. I've spent a lot of time in and around the world, know a lot about our military and intelligence capability. I have cut bureaucracies down to size and held them accountable. That is what has to happen in Washington, D.C. I understand technology, having spent my career in that space, and technology is very important now. And I understand leadership, which is to challenge the status quo, to unlock the potential of others, and to produce results.
Again, that's Carly Fiorina speaking with you, Clay Masters. And as we close out, Clay, I guess I'll turn to you. Your expectations about what happens next in Iowa, what's the next big development there?
Well, I guess you've got to leave it open too much. But I really do think that as you're seeing these polls kind of jostle between Trump and Carson, that there it's not as stable as it might appear. That I really do think that there will be somebody that continues to rise. And in a month, in 2 months, this race here in Iowa is going to look very different. I don't think you can just count on it being this way all the way to February 1st. And then again, it's who can get those people to show up, especially on the Democratic side, where we Iowans did not go for Clinton for 8 years ago. There might be some people that are still around here that don't want to go for her, so maybe they'll caucus for Bernie Sanders. Maybe they'll just stay home. So ask me again in 2 months, and I'll have something very different.
We'll probably check in with you after the Iowa caucuses. Gentlemen, you got up early to be with us. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Clay Masters, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Clay Masters, Morning Edition host for Iowa Public Radio. Ben Kiefer, great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Nice to be on again, Laura. Thank you.
Ben Kiefer, host of IPR's daily noon talk show, River to River. Josh Rogers, we'll talk again. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome, Laura.
Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for us here at NHPR. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Mikesell and Dana Rosinski-Larson. And I'm Laura Knoy.